Leaving the livery stable, Matt returned to the depot, where he bought a ticket for Big Rock. Then, with 3 hours to kill before the train was due to leave, he crossed the street to the saloon. Inside, Meacham and Witherspoon were sitting at a table on the opposite side of the stove from the bar.
You had a clear shot and you missed.
The son of a bitch moved just as I fired.
You missed.
I'll get him next time.
There won't be a next time.
What do you mean?
I'll take care of him myself. Son of a bitch, that's him.
Well, you recognize if he sees you.
He saw me on the train coming up from Pueblo. But I don't think he knows I'm the one that's been trying to kill him.
Been trying? You mean there was another time before we tried out on the road?
Yeah, back in Pueblo.
Meacham told of trying to shoot Matt in his bed in the hotel, only to get Meacham's two fellow assassins killed.
Planned to kill him on the train, but I never got the chance.
You know your problem. You've been sending boys to do a man's job.
What are you gonna do?
I'm going to kill Matt Jensen and make myself $500.
Not in here, you ain't.
You want him dead, don't you?
Yeah, but this ain't the place to do it.
Look, dead is dead in one place as good as another.
Witherspoon slipped a knife from a sheath on his belt.
No, I don't have a stake in this. Not in here.
Oh, you have a stake in it, all right. You have $500 stake in it.
Witherspoon moved to the middle of the saloon floor, then stopped about 20 feet behind Matt. Matt had just taken a drink of his beer when suddenly a knife flashed by in front of him. Instantly, Matt dropped his beer and, turning toward the direction from which the knife had come, drew his pistol even before the beer mug hit the floor. When Witherspoon saw how quickly Matt had drawn his gun, he held his hands up in the air.
No, no, don't shoot, Jensen, don't shoot!
Why the hell not? If you were a little better with that knife, it'd be sticking out of my back right now.
I was just trying to get your attention.
Yeah, well, you got my attention, all right.
I didn't mean nothing by it. It was just a bet, that's all.
Nobody's foolish enough to do something like that for a bet. You the one that's been dogging me?
What do you mean?
Someone took a couple of shots at me out on the road today.
What makes you think it was me?
Because whoever it was wasn't much better with a rifle than you are with a knife.
Was it me?
All right, it wasn't you. But this was. Why'd you try to kill me? And don't tell me again that it was a bet. That'll just get me riled enough to shoot you right where you stand.
All right, I was after you.
Why?
You may not know this, Jensen, but you've got a price on your head.
No, I don't. There's no paper out on me anywhere. I'm not wanted by the law.
I didn't say nothing about the law. I said that you got a price in your head. Someone wants you dead.
Who?
I don't know.
You must know. If you don't know, how do you expect to collect your money?
I won't be collecting any money. I'm through with it now.
You expect me to believe that?
I'll give you my pistol. That'll prove that I'm out of it.
Holding his left hand out, palm facing Matt, as if pleading with him to hold back, Witherspoon reached for his pistol with his right hand, moving very slowly.
I'm just going to pull my gun out real slow. Don't get all excited or anything.
Matt watched as his adversary pulled his pistol from the holster. Then he turned the pistol around so that the butt was pointing toward Matt.
See what I mean? I'm putting up no fight now. And this here saloon is full of witnesses who'll swear I was handing you my gun. You can't shoot me now. If you do now, you'll hang, sure.
Who the hell are you?
My name is Witherspoon. Angus Witherspoon.
Witherspoon? I've heard of you.
You've heard of me? Well, no, I'm just real flattered. I must be doing pretty good for the great Matt Jensen to have heard of me.
All right, Witherspoon, hand me your pistol.
In a totally unexpected maneuver, Witherspoon executed a border roll as fast as if he were drawing the pistol from his holster. Matt suddenly found himself looking down the business end of a Colt 44. The saloon patrons dived or scrambled for cover. White gun smoke billowed out in a cloud that filled the center of the room, momentarily obscuring everything. From his position at the far side of the room, Meacham was as surprised as everyone else. Meacham stared at the cloud of smoke, waiting for it to clear enough for him to see what happened. Finally, the smoke drifted away. Meacham saw Witherspoon standing there, broad smile on his face. Then the smile slowly left his face, his eyes glazed over, and he pitched forward. Matt looked down at Witherspoon for a moment, then holstered his pistol. After that, bedlam broke out in the saloon as everyone hurried over to congratulate Matt, to shake his hand, and to build a memory they could share with their grandchildren many years from now. Conspicuously absent from the crowd of well-wishers was Lucas Meacham. And though Matt didn't know Meacham's name, he was quite familiar with him by now, and he watched as Meacham hurried away from the saloon. He couldn't help but wonder if Meacham wasn't somehow involved in all this. When the Fowlers arrived at the McCann place in their buckboard, they saw several other rigs already there, from surreys to buckboards to wagons. There were a number of children outside the house playing various games. Green jumped down even before the buckboard came to a stop to join in.
Green, be careful! Don't jump down before we've even come to a halt! You can hurt yourself!
I'll be careful, Ma!
Oh, the McCanns have such a beautiful place. Why, did you know that stained glass transom above the door came all the way from St. Louis?
Yes, so Ian has told me more than once.
Well, if he's proud of it, I don't blame him.
Yesterday, Ian McCann had sent his son Leo and his two riders, Dobbins and Toomey, to all the neighboring ranches, inviting them to his house today for a meal and a discussion. Cora McCann came out onto the front porch to welcome them. Sue was invited to join Cora and the other women in the kitchen, while E.B., who had brought a newspaper with him, was directed to the parlor.
So what are we going to do about Denby?
Nothing if you ask me, Kurt. I mean, do you have any idea how many men he's got working for him? The best thing to do, I believe, is let Sheriff Hightower or Marshal Tipton handle it.
Sheriff Hightower never comes up here, and you know it. You also know that neither Marshal Tipton nor any of the folks in Fullerton are going to do anything about it. Denby has them all buffaloed.
Maybe the Petersons have the right idea.
Peterson sold out to Denby.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
So did Thompson and Pratt.
I talked to Don Peterson just before he and Marion left. He went 2 years without making a crop. He said he couldn't hang on anymore, so he went back to Kentucky.
Don't you see? That's what Denby wants. He wants us to all sell out to him.
That would be better than just leaving. And if we get squeezed down so much that we can't make it, the only thing we can do is leave our property for Denby to grab.
If you ask me, this whole business about collecting the toll on the road is just a way of forcing us to leave.
Which is why we're holding this meeting now, to figure out what is the best way to handle it.
Ian, is it true that that son of a bitch actually killed two of your cows for no reason?
Yes, but Frank, it wasn't actually Denby that done it. It was a fella by the name of Bleeker.
That don't matter none whether it was Bleeker that killed your cows or Buttram that killed them two strangers that come to town. Both Buttram and Bleeker worked for Denby, which means he was behind it. So as far as I'm concerned, he's as guilty as they are.
Buttram isn't guilty.
What do you mean he isn't guilty, E.B.? You said yourself you seen him kill those two men.
I didn't say he didn't kill them. I said he wasn't guilty. At least that's what it says here in the paper. Displaying a total lack of moral courage, Marshal Tipton has refused to even hold a hearing on the terrible events so recently transpired. Ollie Buttram, a man who is known not only for his prowess with a firearm, but a willingness to use it, demonstrated his skill and callousness when, with but little provocation, he shot down Billy Gilbert and Jeff Hodges, the two cowboys who now lie buried in the Fullerton Cemetery, many miles from their home.
Putting the paper down, Fowler looked at the others.
Refused to even hold a hearing. Gentlemen, like it or not, this is what we're going to have to deal with, and we're going to be on our own. I'm afraid it's exactly as Ian said. We aren't going to be able to count on either Sheriff Hightower or Marshal Tipton for help.
Sounds to me like that newspaper fella, what's his name?
Bryce. John Bryce.
Yeah, John Bryce. Sounds to me like he's the only fella in town who has any gumption in him at all.
Well, maybe so, but just talking about all this ain't going to get us nowhere. What we need to do, we need to put our heads together and come up with an idea of what to do. We need some sort of a plan.
Well, ain't that why we're here?
Yeah, McCann, you called this meeting. Just what is it you have in mind? Or do you have any idea at all?
I've been thinking about it, and yes, I think I do have an idea. I believe we should all go into town at the same time, and when we come to the toll gate, refuse to pay the toll. If all of us stick together, they won't be able to do anything about it.
Well, now you're talking. I've been saying all along that if we was all to go together, there wouldn't be nothing Denby could do to us.
I don't know. I've been through the toll gate, and the one thing I've noticed is all the guards there have guns. I don't have to tell you that, Ian, seeing as they killed two of your cows.
Well, that's not a problem. We'll carry guns as well.
No, Frank. No guns.
No guns? Now, what do you mean, no guns? If they're armed, how are we gonna fight them if we don't have no guns?
Frank Tanner pulled his pistol out and showed it to the others.
They don't call the Colt an equalizer for nothing, you know.
McCann is right. If we carry guns, they're sure to be shooting. And if they're shooting, someone is gonna get killed.
Yeah, well, that's generally what happens when you have a war. And this is a war as sure as the one we just come through. I was at Antietam, Chancellorsville, and Gettysburg, and by God, we showed those rebels a thing or two. If I wasn't afeard of the rebels, I ain't about to be afeard of some Englishman and the polecats he's got working for him.
You forget, Frank, some of us were in those same battles.
Then you know what I'm talking about, Lewis.
Only we was on the other side.
Yeah, well, we're all on the same side now, ain't we? All I'm trying to say is when the killing starts, we just need to make certain that nearly all the ones getting killed are the ones on the other side.
It doesn't have to be a war.
Then you tell me what you're talking about, Ian. Did you or did you not call this meeting after what happened to you when you tried to take your cows into Indian Agency?
I did.
And did you not just say that we should all go together?
Yeah.
And what exactly are we supposed to do when we get to the toll gate? Get down on our knees and say, "Please, sir, can we pass?"
Not quite like that. But I do think if we present a united front, a group this large all refusing to pay the toll, there won't be anything they can do about it. I don't believe they would just start shooting us in cold blood.
And what makes you think that? They killed them two cowboys for pert near no reason at all. And don't forget, they killed your two cows. And while it's not the same thing as killing a person, it sure shows what kind of people they are.
Frank may have a point, Ian. I mean, more than likely, Denby's men wouldn't start shooting us down in cold blood. But if they did take a mind to do it, oughtn't we have some guns to defend ourselves?
Kurt, if we had guns, it wouldn't be in cold blood, would it? I know it takes some courage for you to do what I'm asking you to do, but I do believe our best chance is just to call their bluff.
Ian, let me ask you this. Did you think they would shoot your cows?
No, I didn't have no idea at all they would do something like that, Frank, but cows aren't people. I don't think they would shoot a person down in cold blood.
Oh, no? What about what happened in town? Didn't Buttram shoot these two strangers down in cold blood?
It wasn't exactly cold blood. I was there. I saw it. The two strangers were armed. They were not only armed, they went for their guns first. I'm not saying Buttram didn't prod them into drawing, but they did draw first. And if they hadn't gone for their guns, I don't think Buttram would have shot them. Not in front of the whole town.
Well, the newspaper said Buttram drew with no provocation.
No, it says that he had little provocation. We don't know what kind of provocation they might have had. Like I said, the two men were armed and they did draw first. Or at least they tried to draw first.
That is exactly why I don't want us to go armed.
And who put you in charge?
I put myself in charge. I'm the one that called this meeting, and I'm the one who suggested that we all go together next time we go to town. So if you are going to be a part of this, then I am in charge.
I have no problem with Ian being in charge, whether self-appointed or not. But just to make it official, I say we vote on it. I nominate Ian McCann as head of our group.
I'll second that.
All in favor?
Aye.
The vote was unanimous. Except for Frank Tanner.
Yeah, all right. I figure when you come right down to it, especially since you got the biggest ranch of all of us, that you're the one that should be in charge. Aye.
Good. If that's all settled, then I think we should go in next Saturday morning.
Men rose and made their way to the dining room. All but two, who hung back from the others.
Tell me, E.B., do you really think we'll be able to force Denby to take down that toll gate by doing this?
I don't know, but we've got to start somewhere. We can't just sit back and let him run roughshod over us like this.
Maybe Frank is right. Maybe we should all go armed.
I don't think so. Not yet, anyway.
Not yet?
Let's face it, Ralph. There may come a time when this develops into a shooting war. I hope it doesn't, but I'll fight before I completely surrender to him.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess I will too.
As a newspaper man, John Bryce spent a lot of time visiting with the good citizens of the town of Fullerton, not only to sell advertising and subscriptions to his paper, but also to gather news and run down rumors. Following up on a few leads, John learned that the small ranchers and farmers of the valley were planning to gather into one large group to come into town on Saturday, hoping by sheer numbers to force their way through the gate. He decided that he would ride out to the gate to witness the confrontation. Realizing that the toll gate across the Ellendale Road would be the point of confrontation between the small ranchers, farmers, and Denby's men, John approached from Fullerton, which put him on the north side of the toll gate. He came to within 60 feet of the gate, then stopped.
You coming through the gate, newspaper man?
I don't think so.
Then what are you doing out here?
John dismounted and tied off his horse. Then he climbed halfway up the side of a small hill and sat down.
I'm just taking the air.
Taking the air, you say? Well, my advice to you is to not get in the way.
Get in the way of what?
A bunch of pig farmers are gonna try and surprise us. Only we ain't the ones going to get surprised, if you get my meaning. So like I said, just don't get in the way.
John wasn't all that surprised that Bleeker knew about what the farmers and small ranchers had planned. After all, he knew about it, so it wasn't that much of a secret. But exactly what that would portend, he had no idea. The elevated area where John chose to wait did give him an excellent view of the toll gate, as well as the road on the other side, so he settled in to watch. Shortly after he sat down, he saw someone else come up to join the two gate guards. He started when he recognized that the new man was Ollie Buttram. Buttram was easy to recognize because he was a head and shoulders shorter than the other two men. For a moment, John wondered what Buttram was doing here. Then he realized that Denby had probably decided to send Buttram to the toll gate to deal with the farmers and ranchers rather than let Beaker and Carver deal with them. That wasn't good. Bleeker and Carver were bad enough by themselves, but the addition of Buttram could only make the situation much more volatile. Even as John was contemplating Buttram's presence, he saw approaching from the south a rather substantial body of men. The ranchers and farmers were coming, and John felt a sense of foreboding. He'd come out here thinking the challenge to Denby's right to charge a toll might be newsworthy. But now, with Buttram standing alongside the gate guards, he feared that it could turn into something much worse. John wanted to yell at them, to tell them to go back, and he actually stood up, preparatory to doing just that, when Bleeker called out to the approaching riders.
Hold up there!
The natural formation of the terrain amplified the voices, so that from John's viewpoint, he could hear as well as see everything that was going on.
Where do you think you're going?
We're going into town.
The farmers and ranchers came all the way up until they stopped at the gate itself.
Open the toll gate, Bleeker.
Are you in charge of this group?
I am.
How many of you are there?
There are 23 of us.
Then the toll will be $23.
Bleeker, you can tell your boss that we don't intend to pay the toll. Not now, not ever again. And as you can see, we got no cows with us for you to kill. Now kindly step aside and open that gate.
I'll open up the gate when you give me $23.
And if we don't give you $23, what are you gonna do? Do you plan on shooting two or three of us like you did my cattle? I don't think even you would shoot a man in cold blood, so I'm asking, no, I'm demanding that you open that toll gate.
Mister, you ain't in position to demand nothing, and you ain't going through the gate without paying the $23.
Oh yes, we are, and by God, you ain't stopping us.
Frank Tanner moved away from the rest of them. He was holding a gun in his hand, and he was pointing it at Bleeker, who so far had not drawn his own pistol.
Frank, I said no guns!
I know what you said! Maybe the rest of you are afraid to face these people, but I ain't! No, by God, I ain't scared at all!
Tanner turned his attention back to Bleeker.
And I'm telling you right now, mister, if you don't open that gate, I'll shoot you as dead as McCann's cows!
Ollie Buttram stepped out in front of the other two guards, and though he had not drawn his pistol, it loomed large and ominous from his side.
put that gun away, cowboy.
Oh, my God, Frank, do what he says. That's Buttram, the one we were talking about.
I don't care who it is. Maybe the little turd ain't noticed that while his gun is still in his holster, mine's right here in my hand.
You ain't afraid of me?
Why should I be afraid of you? Like I said, your gun is in your holster, mine's in my hand.
So it is. So it is. But your gun isn't pointed at me, is it?
No. No, it ain't. It's pointed at this feller. And you've just given me an idea. If you don't unbuckle that gun belt and let it fall, I'll just have to blow this fella's brains out.
Prove it.
What? What'd you say?
I said, prove it. Shoot him.
Maybe you don't think I'm serious.
No. You told me you're gonna do it, so I figure you're serious. But I don't care. You can go ahead and kill him. He don't mean nothing to me. Hell, I don't even like that son of a bitch.
Tanner suddenly swung his pistol toward Buttram, but as he did so, Buttram drew, the gun appearing in his hand so fast that Tanner wasn't certain it hadn't already been there. Tanner, with a look of shock on his face, dropped his pistol and slapped his hand over a chest wound. Blood began spilling through his fingers, and he fell back onto the road. 10 men, all armed, came out of the trees alongside the road. From the hillside, John recognized Slater, Dillon, and Wilson. But there was also some he'd not seen before. That was when he realized that Denby, having heard of the plans of the small ranchers and farmers, had put into operation a plan of his own.
Well now, looks to me like Mr. Buttram just saved you boys a dollar. With that fella dead, it means you only owe me $22. And you can either pay me now, or you can turn around and go back home. Or you can try and force your way through and wind up just like your friend there. Which'll it be?
Come on, men. We're going home.
A couple of the men with McCann dismounted and picked up Tanner's body. They laid him belly down over his own horse. Then, remounting, they rode off with the others.
If any of you folks want to come through here on your own and pay the toll, why, you're mighty welcome!
John's wife, Millie, was cleaning the newspaper office and arranging the type for Thursday's issue when John came in.
Well, was your ride out there newsworthy?
Yeah, it was newsworthy.
What happened?
They killed Frank Tanner, Millie. They shot him down in cold blood.
Oh, John, no. His poor wife. Amy will be lost without him.
Yeah.
And he was shot down in cold blood, you say? Who did it?
Well, actually, it wasn't really cold blood. Tanner had his pistol out and was threatening to use it. He always was pretty much of a hothead. You remember how he got into a fight with that miner at the dance that night? Just because he asked Amy for a dance?
Yes, I remember. Who shot him, do you know?
Oh yeah, I know. It was Buttram. Same person who shot those two cowboys.
And you say Frank already had his gun out?
Yeah.
Then that means there won't be anything done about this killing either, will there? Buttram will just go on killing with impunity, backed by Denby and tolerated by the marshal in this town. Nobody will do anything about it.
No, that's not true. I'm going to do something about it.
Do what? I don't like it when you talk this way.
I'm going to put out an extra.
An extra? Oh, John, I don't know. So many people have pulled their advertising from us that we barely have enough money to put out our regular paper. Do you really intend to do an extra?
Millie, the name of this newspaper is the Fullerton Defender. Defender! If I don't do something to defend the rights of the people in this town, then the paper is not worthy of its name.
What will an extra do but get more people upset with you?
A strongly written article can do much to arouse an oppressed people. You've heard of Thomas Paine, haven't you?
Yes, of course I've heard of Thomas Paine.
Well, you might call me the Thomas Paine of the West. Only instead of a broadside, I'll be putting out an extra.
Before starting, John walked over to the front door, turned the sign around to read closed, and pulled down the long green shade that shut off the door window.
Now you set the type. I'll dictate the story.
Millie walked over to the type trays. She looked up at her husband.
I'm ready.
These are the times that try men's souls.
It took but 1 hour to print 500 newspapers, that number being sufficient to supply a paper to virtually every family in the county. Once the print run was completed, John stepped out onto the front porch of his office. Hearing the whistle, Kenny Perkins came out of his ma's boarding house, and when he did so, John waved him over.
Yes, sir?
I have some papers for you to deliver.
Today? But this ain't paper day.
I put out an extra. Don't worry. You'll get paid extra to deliver it.
Yes, sir!
After Kenny delivered all the papers to the subscribers, he stood out on the street corner shouting, "Extra!" until the rest of the papers were sold. Less than an hour after he left the office, he came back with the collected money, wearing a broad smile.
Here you are, Kenny, 50 cents. You did a good job. Thank you.
Yes, sir, and thank you, Mr. Bryce. Everyone is talking about your paper today. I ain't get a chance to read it, but you must have said something important, because whatever you wrote got them all riled up.
I hope it did, Kenny. I sure hope it did.
Shortly after Kenny left, Mayor Adam Felker came into the office clutching a copy of today's extra.
John, are you crazy?
I don't think so, Mayor. Mind closing the door?
Well, I think so. Writing this article ain't gonna do a damn thing in the world but make Dan be mad.
Good. That's what I set out to do, and if you're honest with yourself, Adam, you'll agree with me.
Well, what if I do? The point is, Denby has us between a rock and a hard place. Why, do you know that right now almost 80% of all business done in this town is through Denby? If he was to pull his support away from Fullerton and take it somewhere else, where do you think that would leave us?
Free of him.
Bankrupt, that's where. Now, I think you ought to write a retraction and put it in Thursday's paper.
A retraction? What good would that do? And what would make anyone believe me anyway?
You could say you've been thinking about it and you have second thoughts. You're a good writer, John. You could make it real believable.
Tell me, Adam, do you think the rest of this town thinks just as you do?
I know they do.
Has a citizens' committee come to you and asked you to come talk to me about this?
Well, no, but...
Just then, Ernie Westphaling poked his head in the open door.
John, excellent story. You said what's on everyone's mind. Keep up the good work, and the whole town is behind you.
Thanks, Ernie.
John turned back to Felker.
Well?
Felker started to say something, and though his jaws worked, nothing came out. Finally, in obvious anger and frustration, he turned to leave.
This is gonna mean trouble, John. You mark my words. This is gonna mean trouble.
Sir?
Yes, Mr. Tolliver?
Mr. Buttram is here to see you, sir.
Show him in, please.
Yes, my lord.
Denby put a bookmark between the pages he was reading, then closed the book and set it aside. He poured whiskey into a glass, and he handed it to the little man when he came in.
Thank you.
What is it, Mr. Buttram? Why have you left your post in town?
I came out here because that newspaper editor has done wrote another one of them articles. He put it out in something that's called an extra. All the folks in town is talking about it now.
Well, what does he say?
It's all full of highfalutin talk, so it's kind of hard for me to understand all that much, to tell you the truth. But I figured a smart man like you can most likely read it and figure it out all right. So that's why I brung one of them papers with me for you to see.
Denby cringed and ground his teeth at the fractured grammar, but he said nothing, realizing that a silk purse could not be made from a sow's ear. So, Mr. Bryce put out an extra, did he? And it is all about me?
Yes, sir. And it ain't just about the shooting. It goes on about the toll and the like. Like I said, it's got a lot of folks in town talking.
Let me read it. Denby turned his nose up slightly as he took the paper from him. Then he read aloud the first line. These are the times that try men's souls. Oh, good one, Mr. Bryce. Very good. Don't you think so, Mr. Buttram?
I don't know. I don't know what that means.
You've never heard that line before?
No, sir. I ain't.
Well, Mr. Buttram, it is a line that is borrowed from one of your own treasonous rebels.
Who would that be?
Thomas Paine.
No, sir. I don't reckon I ever met nobody by that name. Leastwise, not that I can recall.
I believe you said that all the people in town are talking about this article?
Yes, sir. Everywhere you go, you hear folks talking about it.
What are they saying?
Well, sir, they're saying they don't think it's right for you to be collecting a toll like you're doing. And they are wondering why nobody is doing nothing about it.
I see.
But then some of them is worried about it. And they say they don't think the newspaper fella should be writing articles like that. They don't want to make you mad.
Sensible people, I would say.
If you ask me, Mr. Lord Denby, the fella that's causing all the trouble is this here newspaper man.
I would say that you're right.
Just messing up his office like Slater and them boys done ain't gonna stop this man. No, sir. He's got more gumption than just about anybody I've ever seen.
I suppose that's right. He is a troublemaker.
Now, if and you want me to this time, I can fix it so he won't be giving you no more trouble.
How?
I'll kill him for you. If you want me to.
Oh, I wouldn't say that we're ready to go that far yet. You just keep doing what you're doing. Make certain nobody gets in or out of town without paying the toll.
Well, I may have to kill a few more people. I hope that don't bother you none.
Mr. Buttram, other than your unique talent for killing, can you think of any other reason I might have hired you? Why should that bother me?
Just so you know.
I don't care how many people you kill, as long as you manage to keep it legal. If your activities result in your being indicted for murder, you are on your own. I will neither defend you, nor will I pay a lawyer to defend you. Do you understand that, Mr. Buttram?
Oh, yeah. All I have to do is make him draw first.
Now, I want you to wait around for a moment or two. I'm going to write a letter to Mr. Bryce, and I want you to take it to town to the post office.
No need to do that, Mr. Lord Denby. I can just take the letter directly to Bryce's own self.
No. No, I do believe the letter will have more effect if you take it to the post office. It will be more official that way.
Yes, sir. Whatever you say.
Buttram waited quietly until Denby finished the letter. Once he finished, Denby folded it, put it into an envelope, and sealed it.
This feller you got working for you, Tolliver?
Yes? What about Mr. Tolliver?
I get the opinion he don't care much for me.
Your feeling is accurate. He doesn't like you.
Yeah. Well, why not? I ain't never done nothing to him.
No, and you never shall. Not if you intend to remain in my employ.
John Bryce was setting type for the regular weekly paper when Millie came into the newspaper office. She held out several envelopes.
Look at this!
What is it?
It's mail! Mail from people about the extra edition we put out.
I thought you said you were opposed to the extra edition.
I was then, because I thought it was a waste of money. But if we get this many letters in response, that means it struck a resonant chord. And that has to convert into more business for us. Why, I'll bet we get half a dozen new advertising accounts from this.
Accounts? Is that all you think about? Don't you care a whit about the responsibility of a newspaper to look out for the public?
We can't very well look out for the public if we don't have enough money to publish.
Touché, my dear. I suppose you do have me there.
Listen to this letter from the fire chief, Walter Bowman. In times of trouble, the people of our great nation have always been able to count upon the valor and industry of its most courageous citizens. You, sir, have the soul of a crusading journalist, and our fair community is blessed to have you as our advocate. And this one's from Paul Deckert. Keep up the good work, John. The whole town is behind you.
Millie held up the next letter, but didn't open it.
Oh, this one can't be good.
Well, why not? Who's it from?
It's a letter from Mr. Denby.
Read it.
I'd rather not. You read it.
Millie handed the unopened envelope over to John. He opened it, then pulled out the single page. He read for a moment, and then smiled.
Now we are getting somewhere.
Getting somewhere? What do you mean? What does the letter say?
He says that I may have had a point with my article, that perhaps he is hurting business in town. He also says that he would not want to kill the town as it serves a necessary function. He asked me to come talk with him.
Are you going to go see him?
Yeah. After all, I'm the one that organized the ball. I at least owe him a dance.
2 miles south of Fullerton, on the Fullerton-Ellendale Road, John reached the toll gate. Bleeker and Carver were sitting on the side of the road, and Bleeker, sucking on a long stem of grass, got up to approach him.
You know the rules, newspaper man. It's going to cost you $1 to get through.
I will not pay $1 to pass through here. I received a letter from Denby asking me to come speak with him. I will not pay $1 merely for the privilege of speaking with a despot.
What's a despot?
It means someone who is assuming more power than is rightly his. Someone like Denby, who is acting like a tyrant.
A what?
Never mind. I'm afraid you lack the necessary intelligence to comprehend the meaning. Open the gate.
No, without you pay the $1. Let him through.
You know what Lord Denby said? He said everyone has to pay.
But the newspaper editor here is going to see the boss. I say let him through.
Carver thought for a moment and then swung the gate open.
All right, mister. You can go on through.
John nodded but said nothing as he rode by the open gate, heading toward Denby's house. 10 of the several thousand acres of Prestonshire-on-Elm had been set aside and exquisitely landscaped. These were the grounds on which Denby's house, Denby Manor, was situated. It was a house one might expect to see in the English countryside, but scarcely on the range in Dakota territory. 3 stories high, with a mansard roof and corner towers. Nigel Denby had gone all out to create the most grandiose home he could. The house was approached by a long, wide avenue, paved with white limestone and lined with aspen trees. The avenue ended at a large circular drive in front of the house, the centerpiece of which was a dramatic statue of Denby himself. John was met by a uniformed groomsman who held the horse as the newspaper editor dismounted.
I'm here to see Denby.
Yes, sir. If you will avail yourself of the bell pull at the front door, someone will see to you.
Avail myself of the bell pull? Someone teach you to say that?
Yes, sir. Mr. Tolliver, he taught us all to say that whenever someone comes up. I'll give your horse food and water.
John climbed the broad steps up to the porch, then, crossing the porch to the huge carved oak door, he pulled on a rope that hung alongside. He could hear the melodic chimes echoing from within the house. Mr. Tolliver answered. John recognized Tolliver because he had seen him in town before.
Denby invited me to come visit with him.
Tolliver winced at the disrespectful tone.
Wait here, sir. I will see if the master of the house is receiving.
A moment later, Tolliver returned.
Lord Denby is in the library. If you would follow me, sir.
The library, as John knew it would be, was a beautiful room of rich mahogany, lined with bookshelves that were filled with books of various sizes and hues. Denby was standing in the middle of the room, wearing a white robe that featured upon the left breast the Denby family crest. A black lion with red claws, rampant against a white shield, filled with many small black fleur-de-lis.
Mr. Bryce, I am pleased that you accepted my invitation.
I'm here. What do you want to talk about?
Denby walked over to his desk, then picked up a folded copy of the Fullerton Defender.
These are the times that try men's souls. You are quite the crusading scribe, aren't you?
It's called freedom of the press. While we don't have titles in America, we do have freedom of the press. It's in our Constitution. You have heard of our Constitution, haven't you?
What would it take, Mr. Bryce, to hire your services?
Hire my services? What do you mean, hire my services? Hire my services for what?
I would like to hire your services to be my advocate, rather than my adversary. Such things are done, I know. It would not be unprecedented, nor would it be unsavory to hire you to write something favorable about me.
It would be more than unsavory. It would be absolutely dishonest.
Would it?
Denby picked up an earlier copy of the Defender and began to read.
Fuller and Simpson, men's furnishing goods, shirts and underwear of all kind, the finest men's furnishing goods store in America.
Denby put the paper down and smiled at John.
Really, Mr. Bryce,
Are you telling me that there is no other men's furnishing goods store anywhere in America that is as good as Fuller and Simpson?
That is merely an advertisement, sir. A certain degree of hyperbole is allowed, indeed is expected in advertisements.
Well then, that should ease your conscience. I will hire you to write favorable advertisements about me.
No, I cannot, and I will not. I believe that your actions are stifling, indeed killing, not only Fullerton, but nearly all of Dickey County. I will not support you. On the contrary, I will fight you as hard as I can.
I'm sorry to hear that, Mr. Bryce. Terribly sorry. I had hoped that you and I could come to some sort of an accommodation.
Well, that was my hope as well. You said in your letter that you thought I had a point in my article. In fact, I believe you said you would not want to kill the town as it serves a necessary function.
Did I?
You did. I took that to mean that you were willing to discuss removing the toll from Ellendale Highway.
Ah, I see. You took it wrong. He made a motion with his fingers toward Tolliver.
Yes, my lord.
Do show Mr. Bryce out, will you, Mr. Tolliver?
Yes, my lord.
That's it. This is the end of our conversation?
Mr. Bryce, do be careful on your ride back to town.
When Matt stepped down from the train in Big Rock, he waited on the platform until his saddle and saddlebags were offloaded. Then, picking them up, he walked across the road from the depot to Mercer's Corral, where, according to a professionally lettered sign, one could rent horses, buckboards, and wagons.
Hello.
Oh, yes, sir. I'll be right with you.
No big hurry, Bob. I never like to disturb a man at his work.
Bob looked up.
Well, Matt Jensen, as I live and breathe.
Matt shook Bob's hand.
What can I do for you, Matt?
I just came in on the train. I'd like to rent a horse for a while.
Oh, yes, sir. I'll pick out a good one for you. Are you going to be here long?
Not too long. Thought I'd ride out and visit with Smoke for a spell.
Yeah, I thought that might be what brought you back here. Is Smoke back?
Back? I don't know. I didn't know he was gone. This wasn't a planned trip. It just happened by.
Well, he may be back. I don't know. All I know is he left a few days ago for who knows where. You never know with Smoke. He's one traveling man. Oh, but Sally didn't go with him, so even if he isn't here, you can say hi to her.
Yeah, I'll do that.
Miss Sally? Miss Sally?
Yes, Cal? What is it?
There's a rider coming.
Oh, is it Smoke?
Cal appeared at the open front door of the Sugarloaf Ranch house.
Oh, no, ma'am. It ain't him. I don't know who it is.
Oh, God in heaven. Cal, do you think...
No, ma'am, I don't think that. If something happened to Smoke, it'd be more likely be Sheriff Carson coming to tell us, or maybe Mr. Longmont. He wouldn't be no stranger.
Oh, yes. I'm sure you're right.
Sally looked out the front door toward the rider. For a long moment, the anxiousness did not leave her face. Then, suddenly, she relaxed and broke into a great smile.
Well, I'll be. It's Matt. Oh, my goodness, I haven't seen him in ages.
Matt who? Who's Matt?
An old friend.
15 minutes later, Matt, Pearlie, and Cal were sitting around the kitchen table. Sally was in the kitchen as well, but at the moment she was standing by the stove with the oven door open. The kitchen was redolent with the sweet aroma of freshly baked bear claws.
You should have seen him. Pearlie hung out of that bull like a tick on a dog, and no matter what that bull did, going this way and that, humping in the middle, kicking out his hind legs, he couldn't shake Pearlie.
Cal didn't do bad his own self. He won the calf roping and the bulldogging contest.
I'm sure Smoke will be proud of both of you. I'll tell you the truth, Miss Sally, that smells mighty good.
Sally makes the best bear claws in Colorado.
Sally makes the best bear claws in the whole world.
You boys don't have to butter me up. I'm baking enough bear claws to satisfy even your appetites.
Too bad Smoke isn't here to enjoy them.
Yeah, I'd hope to see Smoke. Where is he anyway?
Well, he's in Nevada. Nicole's brother, Bobby Lee Cabot, got himself into some trouble, and Smoke went to help him out.
Really? What sort of trouble has Bobby Lee got himself into? Haven't seen him in a long time.
Oh, wait a minute. You know this fella, Bobby Lee, do you?
Sure do.
How come you know him, we don't?
Cal, Matt knew Nicole, Smoke's first wife.
Wow, I had no idea you'd known Smoke that long.
Oh, I knew Smoke long before he ever thought about marrying Nicole. But yeah, I knew Nicole. I also knew Art, the baby.
Yeah, I know about Smoke's first wife and his kid. I know they was both killed, and I know Smoke killed the ones who done it. Didn't know you knew him, though.
Oh, that's understandable, Cal, since you didn't even know about Matt until a few minutes ago.
When did you first meet Smoke, Matt?
You might say Smoke met me, Pearly.
What you mean?
I was nothing but a kid, starving and freezing to death in the mountains when Smoke found me. If he hadn't found me when he did, I'd have been dead within another few hours.
You might say that Smoke's finding you was quite fortuitous.
Why, Pearly, fortuitous? I'm impressed.
Well, yes, ma'am. I learned that word while I was at the rodeo in Denver, and I've been looking for a chance to use it.
Oh, speaking of that, Matt, one might also say that your stopping by is quite fortuitous.
Fortuitous in what way?
Yesterday I received a letter for you. I was going to give it to you before you left, but this seems like as good a time as any.
A letter from me?
Yes. Well, it was addressed to Smoke, but when I opened it, I saw that it was actually meant for you.
Who's the letter from?
It's from a man named John Bryce. Do you know him?
John Bryce?
Matt thought for a moment, then he nodded.
Yeah, I remember John Bryce. Smoke and I met him a long time ago. I was about to be tried for robbery and murder, the charge lodged by a crooked assayer. Since I was a stranger to the town, the sheriff took his word over mine. I hadn't been tried yet, but it wasn't looking good for me, and Smoke had already determined to break me out of jail if need be. Of course, if he'd done it, that would have made criminals out of both of us. But just before the trial, John Bryce, who was a journalist for a local newspaper at the time, wrote a story that cleared me. I have a letter from him, you say?
Yes. Well, just a moment. I'll get it for you.
Dusting the residue of flour from her hand, Sally walked over to a secretary bookcase, opened the curved glass door, and took out an envelope, which she handed to Matt. Matt removed the letter from the envelope and then turned it slightly to catch the morning sunlight. The cursive letters were formed by neat and even strokes on the stationery.
He sure has a neat hand, doesn't he?
He certainly does. I taught school for 7 years and never encountered anyone with such penmanship.
Matt read the letter.
Dear Mr. Matt Jensen, I do hope you remember me, though, as our paths crossed so long ago, I would not be at all surprised if you have forgotten the humble journalist whose investigative reporting once freed you from the unjust accusation of murder and robbery. Although I intend this letter to be for Matt, I am addressing to Smoke, because whereas I know that Smoke Jensen can be reached at Sugarloaf Ranch, I do not know how to get in contact with Matt. I feel some degree of confidence that this will reach Smoke, and I ask, if you are still in contact with Matt Jensen, that you forward this missive to him. Matt, I recall that you once promised to come to my aid should I ever require it. I require it now. Though I am ever mindful of the fact that any obligation to me, if it had ever existed at all, would have been totally satisfied by your generous donation of money, by which I was able to start a newspaper. I hasten to add, however, that it is not for me alone that I seek help, but rather for the people of the town of Fullerton and the county of Dickey in Dakota Territory. The hapless citizens of this fair community are sorely in need of justice, that commodity being denied us by the nefarious operations of an evil Englishman who, by stint of wealth and landholdings, holds us all in his grip. The person of whom I speak is Nigel Cordell Denby. I have no wish to make a request that would be a disruptive imposition, but if you are available, and if you would be so inclined as to pay a visit to the offices of my newspaper, the Fullerton Defender in Fullerton, Dakota Territory, I would be eternally grateful. I must tell you, though, that any help you might supply us would have to be gratis, for I can offer you nothing but the guarantee of good home-cooked meals prepared by my wife, Millie, an uncomfortable bed in our spare room, and the undying gratitude of a newspaper editor who is giving test to the adage, "The pen is mightier than the sword." Your friend, John Bryce.
When Matt finished the letter, he folded it, returned it to the envelope, then handed it to Sally.
How long have you had the letter?
Oh, just since yesterday.
That means it's still timely.
I would think so. Are you going to answer his request?
Yeah, I'll go. I'd be honored to go. I'll leave right away.
I don't know the man, but if he's responsible for saving you from hanging, then I am glad you're going to help him.
Now I need to ask a favor of you.
Of course.
I need a horse. Spirit broke his leg and I had to put him down.
Oh, Matt, I know what Spirit meant to you.
Yes, ma'am. He sort of carried on the spirit of the first Spirit, if you know what I mean. I'd like another horse that can do that as well. Seeing as I got Spirit 1 from Smoke, I think it'd be really good if I could get Spirit 3 from him as well. Of course, I intend to buy him, not take him as a gift the way I did the first one.
Smoke took Seven with him, but he left Drifter behind. You can have any horse but Drifter. Cal, take Matt out to the corral.
Oh, yes, ma'am. Miss Sally, does that mean any horse?
Reading the expression on the young man's face, Matt knew what was troubling him.
Cal, point out Drifter. All the horses you and Pearlie are riding. I'll pick from the rest.
A wide, relieved smile spread across Cal's face.
Oh, yes, sir. Come on out. Smoke has some really great horses.
After looking through the horses in the Sugarloaf stable, Matt saw one that appealed to him. Examining the horse carefully, he saw a coat that glistened like burnished copper, though his long tail was somewhat lighter. The horse was just under 17 and a half hands at the withers, completely blemish-free, and a model of conformation.
What you think about that one?
You know the horse?
Matt rubbed the horse behind his ear, and the horse dipped his head in appreciation.
I know him. He's a good horse. He can run like the wind, and he'll hold to a good trot all day without tiring.
What do you think, Spirit? You want to come with me?
You're going to name him Spirit?
That's his name.
Well, I thought you said your other horse was named Spirit.
Both my other horses are named Spirit.
You're just like Smoke. He names all his horses Seven or Drifter.
You find a good name, why give it up?
Walking over to the rental horse, Matt removed the saddle and put it on Spirit 3. Spirit stood tall and proud, accepting the saddle without the slightest complaint.
Yes, sir. We're going to get along just fine.
As Matt tightened the saddle cinches, Cal and Pearlie stood with him. He finished just as Sally came out of the house carrying a small sack.
You didn't have to come out here. I was going to come back in to pay you for the horse and tell you goodbye.
If I took money for the horse, Smoke would be all over me. He's yours.
I don't feel right about just taking him without paying you.
Then take it up with Smoke next time you see him. I thought you might enjoy these. I'm sending some bear claws with you.
Thanks. I know I'll enjoy them.
But you kept some behind now, didn't you, Miss Sally?
Yes, Cal, I kept some behind.
Matt took the bag of bear claws, shook hands with Cal and Pearlie, then swung into the saddle. Pearlie had put a lead bridle on the rental horse, and he handed it to Matt.
You can just leave this lead bridle with Mr. Mercer at the livery in town. One of us will pick it up next time we go in.
Thanks.
Matt touched the brim of his hat.
Tell Smoke I'm sorry I missed him, but I'll drop back by sometime in the not-too-distant future.
I will. Be careful, Matt. I don't know what was behind this letter, but I've learned, since living with Smoke, that most of the time when someone sends a letter like that asking for help, it's not just a walk in the park.